The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Moshe Brisky now presents his lecture, The Choice Points of Life, The Power of Free Will.
Several times throughout the Rosh Hashanah prayers, we're about to bless the new month of Elul, which leads into the high holidays, we make the following statement. Hayom Haras Olam. Today is the birthday of the world. Rosh Hashanah is celebrated as the anniversary when God created the world. Or is it? In actuality, the first day of the month of Tishrei does not respond to the first day of the creation of the world. It corresponds to the sixth day of the creation of the world. And what happened on the sixth day? It's the day God created Adam and Eve, the first human beings. So when we call it Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the year, it's the beginning of the creation of the world of man, that man was part of the creation of the world when man arrived on the scene. For as impressive as everything that God created before man may have been, and it was impressive, the planets and the galaxies and the oceans and the dry lands and the birds and the bees and sea life and animal life, it is man, it is only man, that would bring the realization of God's entire purpose for creation in the world, of the world in the first place. So what is it about man that empowers him or her to do this? What distinctive quality do human beings possess that puts us in a quantumly different category than any other species or form of creation? So I'd like to answer the question with a fascinating story. At the UC Irvine School of Medicine, there's a forensic psychiatrist and neuroscientist. His name is Dr. James Fallon. Don't confuse him with Jimmy Fallon of The Tonight Show. Different Fallon. Dr. Fallon has been hailed as one of the world's leading experts on reading brain scans. In recent decades, this science has advanced so much so that doctors and scientists are now able to pinpoint which functions of the brain are responsible for a person's very specific emotions and behaviors. Dr. Fallon, in particular, has been known to use brain imaging to diagnose various mental disorders, like schizophrenia, depression. In fact, he would often be called upon by defense attorneys all over the world to testify on behalf of serial killers at their sentencing, so that he can explain to the judge that the monstrous act committed by these individuals were not so much the result of a conscious choice they had made, as much as the fact that their brains are wired that way. They're wired to kill. And they had no choice. And he could even demonstrate it by showing these brain scans and showing the judge, this is proof that on this individual's brain, that's the way the brain is wired. In 2005, Dr. Fallon decided to expand the field of study by exploring what brain scans could tell him about Alzheimer's disease. Is there any way from seeing that in a brain scan? And for his test case, he decided to start with the scans belonging to the members of his own family. His family, cousins, he would start with these scans and he would use these as his test case. So there he is, one afternoon looking through a pile of family brain scans when he sees something absolutely shocking, unnerving, mind-blowing. The scan that he was analyzing read like the brain of a psychopath. There was low brain activity in the frontal and temporal lobes, which are linked to empathy, morality, self-control. These were the classic signs he'd identified now hundreds and hundreds of times of someone destined to do terrible things. How upsetting it is to know that such a scan belonged to someone within his own family, a relative of his. So the first thing he did was check the PET machine to see if there was some malfunction. Something must have been wrong, but no, it was in perfect working order. He then confronts his research assistant, accusing him of having mixed up these scans with other scans in his lab. And the assistant double checks and says, "No, sorry, doc, there's no mistake. That scan definitely came from the batch collected from the Fallon family." That gets him very worried. Now, generally, while working with scans, the individual's identity remains hidden. But in this case, he felt he simply had to unblind the scan and identify whose brain showed such signs. After all, this relative of his was clearly predisposed to committing who knows what sort of atrocities. What if he or she were to harm or even murder an innocent people, and he had this information? Family or not, this person had to be stopped before they can act. So he looks up the code for the scan and he almost faints. It was his own scan. The psychopathic brain pictured in the scan belonged to none other than James Fallon, the man who had dedicated his life and his career to the notion that psychopaths are wired that way, and therefore not accountable for their behavior, suddenly discovers that he himself was wired to harm, to maim, and to torture, and to kill. And yet, he hadn't done any of those things. Perhaps it was time for him to rethink his whole life's work. Perhaps he was wrong. Maybe the brain scan cannot tell you how people are predisposed to behave. So he then underwent a series of genetic tests, and what he found went from bad to worse. Sure enough, those tests showed a gene in him linked to aggression, to violence, and to low empathy. He took other neurological and behavioral tests, and there again, there was no escaping the scientific conclusion. Dr. James Fallon is a certifiable psychopath. So let me ask you, what would you do with this information if you discovered this about yourself? I don't know, I suspect that most of us would probably want to keep it on the down low. I don't think we want to advertise it. I don't think our friends would feel good about hanging out with us if we're a certifiable psychopath. How safe would neighbors feel knowing the guy next door is a psychopath? The good news is chances are they'd never think of blocking your driveway again. How did Dr. Fallon deal with it? Well, perhaps because psychopaths are wired to be uninhibited, he went the complete opposite direction, and he published a new book called The Psychopath Inside, in which he put it all out there, all of the tests about himself, all of his past testimony, stating that this scan belongs to a psychopath, and this scan is mine. And in this book, he tries to reconcile how a happily married family man, an accomplished scientist like himself, could have the same biological markings as a serial killer. Being totally honest, he reflects on his life in his book, and he realizes that he does, in fact, have certain psychopathic behaviors. Looking back at his life, he called himself selfish, obnoxious, fiercely competitive. He wouldn't let his own grandchildren ever win at board games. But now it's making sense to him. Verbally aggressive, coming on strong without realizing it. All these predispositions was there, but he never killed and he never raped and he never even punched anyone. So how is that? How was he able to control his behavior while others with the same genetic and brain structure ended up behind bars? And you can read his book, he gives many different possible answers, but his main conclusion is something very much in line with the Talmud's teachings. The Talmud tells us that at the time of conception, an angel presents each new pregnancy to God, who decrees what physical attributes, intellectual capacity, and socioeconomic statuses this particular person will have in the world. God determines the artistic talent that the soul being sent into this body will have, athletic ability, psychological profile. Everything is predetermined before we're even born. Does that surprise you? Probably not. I think that for many of us, it confirms what we've suspected all along, that no matter how hard we may try to change and adjust different aspects of our lives and our personalities, we feel almost powerless to do so. We feel utterly wired towards certain behaviors. Some of us are predisposed to being lazy. Some of us feel they need to constantly achieve. Some get angry fast, some never get angry. Some have total self-discipline, some don't. Some are very kind by nature, very sharing by nature, some don't. So it seems all pre-programmed. Is the game rigged? Is it stacked against us? Do we really have a say in life? The Talmud seems to be saying it's all rigged. It's all decided before we ever came down. Why was our teacher so angry at us? Why were our parents so angry at us? We are who we are because that's the way we were made. That all might be true and correct had the Talmud stopped there. But the Talmud didn't stop there. It continues with a caveat. A huge caveat. What the angel does not ask God, and what God does not say about person A, B, C, D, X, Y, Z, is if this person is going to be righteous or wicked, good or bad, cruel or compassionate. Hakol b'dei shamayim chutz miyira shamayim. Everything comes from heaven except for the fear of heaven. A person's morality, a person's spirituality, a person's goodness, a person's decency, or opposite thereof are completely up to the individual. Much about life is predetermined, except the essence of our character. And that, my friends, at the end of the day, is everything. Maimonides elaborates on this, and he says that it's true that we all have inborn personality traits, but that nature does not determine the quality or the arc of our lives. In his own words, do not think like the fools among the nations who say that a person's fate is sealed for them at birth. Every human being, no matter who, no matter what, no matter when, and no matter where, has the potential to be among the best of the best, or God forbid, the worst of the worst. Ultimately, says Maimonides, says the Talmud, says Jewish thought, it's up to you. And that is the main conclusion that Dr. James Fallon comes to in his book. His ability to overcome his genetic bias can be summed up in two words, he says: free will. Whereas he once believed that people are mostly products of their genetics and just slightly products of their environment, all of that was turned upside down. He now believes that yes, our genetics may give our lives certain parameters and limitations, but that every person has an inner ability to overcome almost whatever factors may be pulling him or her in destructive or counterproductive directions. Now, based on his new outlook, James Fallon made new efforts to change his own behavior. He just worked harder on things now. In an interview, he puts it this way: after having been an arrogant jerk my whole life, his words, not mine, I started to think of this experience as an opportunity to have something good come from it. I decided to try and use what be considered faults, like narcissism, to take to an advantage, to find ways to utilize it for good. So every time I started doing something, I would stop and look and say to myself, don't do it. Don't do the selfish, self-serving thing here. And step by step, that's what I've been doing the past few years. And what do you know? People started liking me more and more. From psychopath to great guy. Possibly the name of his next book. It is true that we each dealt a unique set of cards in our lives. But it's how we play that cards that's completely up to us. None of our attributes are inherently bad. They're all neutral. And it's up to us to endow those aspects of our personality with value. Our traits may be preset, but how they're controlled and what we dedicate them towards, how we use them, is entirely up to us. You see, unlike angels, we humans have physical bodies. Physical bodies have physical needs. We have drives. We have desires. Unlike animals, we also have spiritual souls, a godly soul, that can exercise self-control. We have something that no other created being in heaven or on earth have, and that's free will. That's what the Torah means when it says that man was created in God's image. The image of God means that we have the ability to make a choice. The lion and the tiger cannot choose. Even Shamu in SeaWorld cannot really choose. It is trained to do certain tricks to get something to eat. It's nature. When you think Shamu is smiling at you in the audience, it's not smiling. It's going through an exercise to get some extra lunch. Only the human being can make a choice and can overcome the inborn animalistic desires that we have, the feelings for passion that we may have, that we have the ability to stop and ask the question, is it good or is it bad? Should I do or should I not? Each of us have the ability to make our own moral choices and thereby chart our own course and choose our own destiny. It's because we have free will that we can be held accountable for our actions. It's why our teacher could ask us why we did something. It's why our parents could ask us. And ultimately, it's why God could ask us. Because we have free will. And it's also this free will that gives our lives meaning. It's because we have free will that each and every one of us, no matter at what age or stage of life we may be, we have the ability to change. Each and every one of us has the capacity to change, to make our lives exponentially better. Some of you may have heard of a woman named Jennifer Teague. Jennifer Teague is the black daughter of a German mother and Nigerian father. When she was very young, her mother, whose name was Monica Goeth, gave her up for adoption, only visiting her occasionally until she was around 7 years old, and then she stopped seeing her altogether. Nevertheless, Jennifer went on to make a good life for herself. She had a wonderful adoptive family, and she loved them very much, and they loved her very much. She ended up going to the Sorbonne University in Paris, and later spent time in Israel, where she attended the University of Tel Aviv and fell in love with the Israeli people and the culture. She even learned to speak fluent Hebrew. Fast forward, she's now 38 years old. She's happily married with a family of her own. She's living in Hamburg, Germany. She's browsing in the library one day, and she comes across a book. It has a strange title. The title of the book was, I Have to Love My Father, Right? She flips through the pages and she discovers that it was co-authored by the daughter of one of Nazi Germany's most infamous killers, Amon Goeth, the commandant of the Plaszow concentration camp, who was the villain in the movie of Schindler's List. She looks at the picture, the author of the cover, and she eerily resembles a person she had once known. And she studies the biography, and she sees the author, who now was going by the name of Monica Hertwig, was formerly Monica Goeth, her birth mother. The notorious Nazi Amon Goeth was her biological grandfather, a grandfather who was a monster. She had a grandmother who stood by his side, and she had a biological mother who would not denounce her father. All through Jennifer into a tailspin, first of anger, then pain, then revulsion, and then guilt. She went on a series of trips. She visited the Plaso camp. She revisited Israel. She met with survivors, trying to come to terms with these revelations and what it means to her life. Eventually, she published a memoir chronicling her journey, and the title of her book, different than her mother's, My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me, referring to the fate that she would have suffered at the hands of the Nazis on account of her skin color. Today, Jennifer Teague is a full-time motivational speaker. One of her most prominent messages is that we can decide for ourselves who and what we want to be. In her words, our genetics do not determine who we are. Our souls do. And she has told her story to thousands around the world using the legacy of one of the most hated men in history to inspire many to overcome their challenges. Now, most of us, I hope, do not have the baggage of a Jennifer Teague. But we all have baggage. We all have stuff. In Yiddish, we call it our own pekel, our own burdens, our own past negative experiences that we carry on with us through life, some worse than others. Whether it's issues with our parents, issues with our children, family members, relationships, school, religion, career, physical health, mental health, social pressures, financial pressures, we all have challenges to overcome. Or to use lingo, our own demons to slay, our own temptations, our own impulses, our own predispositions, our own handicaps to cope with. Nobody seems to get off scot-free in this life, including those that think they have it easy. So sure, we can spend our lives replaying over and over again everything that's gone wrong, bemoaning everything that we've been deprived of, pointing fingers of blame at parents, at teachers, at politicians, and perhaps legitimately so. We can use our past history and our current drawbacks as perfectly valid excuses for living stagnant or mediocre lives. But at the end of the day, the only one who loses in that scenario is ourselves. There is another alternative. The other alternative is to tell ourselves that for whatever reason, this is a burden I have been saddled with. But as a human being and as a Jew, I choose, yes, I choose to not be broken or weighed down by this. I can and I will rise above this and make something better of my life, either in spite of what I've been through or perhaps even because of it. There was a rabbi I heard who talks about something called choice points, and that's why I made it part of the title of this talk. And he says this: everyone has their own unique choice points. I'll explain what that means. These are situations which we have to put our free will into high gear. It's that challenge moment. We reach that point where we're right there and we need to decide to the right or to the left. Now, as I spoke about in some earlier lectures here at the retreat, what may be a test and challenge for you may not be the same struggle for the other person, and vice versa. We each have different choice points that for us are unique challenges. I gave the example of lobsters that for me, there's no struggle with it. For others, there might be. And we can talk about so many different, because of our upbringings, perhaps are different. Our fears are different. Our challenges are different. But the fact that we will each face those choice points, that's what we all share uniquely. We all face them. The factors leading up to our choice points may be predetermined. It may be divine providence setting up the choice point. So God sets the stage. He sets the props. He sets all the other actors. Everything is set. But you're the main actor on the stage, and you need to deliver your lines. That's up to you. No one can force you. You hold all the cards. You have the total control. The choice is yours. I'll describe this choice points with a story. You know, before Jews were loaded onto the cattle cars and sent off to the camps, they were crammed into horrible ghettos for extended periods of time where they were forced to live in subhuman conditions. With 10 or more people to a room at times, very little food, rampant disease, many perished in the ghetto itself. One day in the Podlatska ghetto, a woman named Leah Fuchs, she was the mother of a very large family, she became very sick. At first, she tried to ignore her aches and her pains, hoping the symptoms would just go away in the morning, but they got worse, worse and worse. She was astute enough to know that if she stayed where she was going to die. And she desperately needed to live, not just for herself, but she had a large family of young children. And she had elderly parents that she was caring for as well. She needed to live for all of them. She needed medical attention. Grabbing the last few zlotys that she had, she fled the ghetto, risking her life. And she sneaked off to the home of Dr. Magda Bukowski. Dr. Magda Bukowski was a Polish doctor that she had known from the years before the Nazis turned life into a living hell. She knocks on Dr. Bukowski's door. Dr. Bukowski opens the door and sees Leah standing there. And she's furious. How dare you, a Jewish woman? You know you can't leave the ghetto. You know you can't come here. You know just by standing here, you're putting my life at risk. Leave my doorstep right now and go back there. At that point, Leah begged the doctor for human compassion. You know me. You know me for years. We know each other. It's okay if I was to die. I'm fine with that. But there are others, children, that are relying on me to live. Help me. Just give me some medicine. Give me something. I'll be out of your way. Whatever it was that she said that won her over, Dr. Bukowski glanced quickly in both directions and ushered Leah in. She examined her, and she gave her the medication needed. Leah thanked her and tried to give her the money she brought with her, but the doctor declined the money, said, no, you keep it. Suddenly some more compassion, suddenly some more understanding. She started asking Leah, what's life like in the ghetto? Although they lived a few blocks away, she might as well have been living on another planet. You see, the Polish people, some consciously and others subconsciously, wanted to turn a blind eye and pretend that war crimes were not occurring daily under their own noses. But now Dr. Bukowski was hearing directly from Leah Fuchs, a patient of hers, about the inhumane, the conditions in the ghetto. Yeah, she heard rumors about it, but she never believed them to be true. And then she tells Leah, in your condition, you can't go back to the ghetto. You won't survive there. The medicine I gave you will last you a day or two, but your illness will take you over. You're not going to survive. And then she says this, it's going to be dangerous, but I have an attic above my house. I'm willing to hide you there. The sudden about-face was startling, but Dr. Burkowski was obviously appalled about what she heard, and she wanted to help. Leah was grateful for the offer, and of course she would have taken her up on it, except for one minor problem. Dr. Burkowski, that's so kind of you, but I have 13 others under my care. My children and my parents and my husband. My children need me and I won't leave them. My parents need me and I won't leave them. At that point, Dr. Burkowski says, then bring all 13 with you. I'll hide them all. It took a few days. Each day they smuggled another one and another one to disguise themselves, to get out of the ghetto, to smuggle their way to Dr. Burkowski's house. And all 14 of them went into this attic. My friends, all 14 were in this attic for 6 years. This remarkable Polish doctor hid 14 Jews in her attic for 6 years. Even more astonishing is the fact that Dr. Burkowski's home was situated right across the Gestapo headquarters. Everyday Gestapo officers who specialized in finding Jews walked by her apartment. She knew full well the fate suffered by other righteous Gentiles who risked their lives to save Jews and were caught, because they would hang them right in front of Gestapo headquarters. And yet, 14 Jews in her attic for 6 years. 6 years after Leah's initial visit to Dr. Burkowski, the Germans were finally defeated, and Leah and her 13 charges left the attic, malnourished, weak, traumatized, but very much alive. God had sent a special angel to watch over them. Eventually, they all recovered and reestablished their lives, each building a family. Years later, Leah Fuchs, together with multitudes of children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, gathered for a reunion in America. By that time, there were 300 family members. There was only one person in the room that was a non-family member, their guest of honor, Dr. Burkowski, the heroic and compassionate doctor. How does something like that happen? How does a non-Jewish Polish woman come to exhibit such self-sacrifice, risking everything to save a woman and her entire family after first seeming so cold and uncaring? And this was the explanation. It was only one choice. There was only one choice. That choice was when she opened the door and Leah was standing there. That was the choice point. Had she closed the door, all other choices would have followed from there. The moment she let Leah through that front door, even before giving her the medicine, everything changed. She changed. She became a different person. The moment she exhibited compassion, compassion became part of who she was. All the other choices, not to take the money from her, to offer her a place, and even the choice of risking her life to put 14 Jews in an attic, and even the choice of letting them live there for 6 years, was nothing in comparison to that first choice. Open the door and let her in. Those are the choice points. Those are those moments in our lives where we have that one moment. The stage is set for us. You have one choice to make. When you make that choice correctly, everything else will flow much easier. Thank God most of the choice points we face in our daily lives aren't matters of life and death, but the message is the same. You're not a victim of your circumstances. You are a human being. You're created in God's image. And regardless of the situation, you always have choices. You have moral choices, spiritual choices, emotional choices. As long as you remember the difference between what is under your control and what is not under your control. One thing always to bear in mind is that the only person that you can really change is yourself. Someone once put it this way. everyone has an inflow pipe and an outflow pipe. The outflow pipe are your thoughts, your words, and your actions. The inflow pipe is everything else that happens in life. When it comes to your outflow pipe, you have 100% control. When it comes to everything else, you have very little control. The three choices that we have are about our lives in thought, speech, and action. The props, the stages of the world, God's more involved in that than we are. He's setting the scene for us. You may not be able to control everything that happens at the office, but you can choose to put a smile on your face for your wife and kids when you come home. That's your choice. Even if you have to fake it, even if you have to force it, you can choose. You get to choose how you get to respond to every situation, because the situation happened without your choice. You had nothing to do with the situation, but you have everything to do with your response to the situation. How many of you find yourself saying this? He made me angry. She made me angry. We all say it, but it's an oxymoron. The truth is, another person cannot make you angry any more than they can make you fat. They could put things in front of you that anger you, or at this retreat, they could put a lot of food in front of you, but the choice is yours. Did you have cheesecake this morning? It was there. It looked great. Did you walk away? Choice is yours. They made you angry? No. You made yourself angry by situations. Now, what could you do? There are other choices. You could choose acceptance. You can choose disregard. Or you can choose transcendence, rise above it. Or how's about compassion? Compassion for the offending party. Why? Because they will have the misfortune of having to live with themselves all the time. Which means you can try to reframe it. My point is that when you choose the high road, a loftier response instead of the impulsive one, you transform yourself from being the victim to the victor. Life is short, and the saying goes, stop spending the time you don't have on people you don't like doing things you don't want to do. The Lubavitcher Rebbe said it this way. If you change the way you look at the things you look at change. Real change will start when we change our perspective. Years ago, there was a young lady by the name of Shandel. She was 14 years old. They opened up a new Chabad Advanced Girls High School in Crown Heights neighborhood, and her father wanted her to go to this high school. Seeking to assert her independence and not wanting to feel like a test case for this new program, Shandel protested. She didn't want to go to a new school. She wanted to go to an established school. Her father was disappointed. He felt that this would be a very good fit, and their compromise was that she would write a letter to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and she would be willing to follow the advice of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So that's what she did. She takes pen and paper. She wrote a rather bold and honest letter to the Rebbe, which she concluded with the following words. I do not want to be a guinea pig. Reflecting on it years later, she realized it was probably not the best choice of words to say to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, using the term guinea pig when you're writing to the Rebbe. But I was a teenager, I was independent in my thinking, and I was adamant that I didn't want to go to the school. A few days later, she gets a letter back from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's her original letter. It was returned to her with a slight modification. The modification was in the Rebbe's handwriting. The Rebbe crossed out the word guinea pig and instead wrote one word, chalutza, pioneer. With one word, the Rebbe was telling this teenager, no one's asking you to be a test case. You're being selected to be a trailblazer. You're being asked to be unique, to be special, to be different, to forge new paths. Chalutza. Now Shandel was excited. You want me to be a pioneer? Ah, that's something I'm up to. Today that school has hundreds and hundreds of students, and the principal of the school today is our own Shandel. By simply reframing the situation, the Rebbe shifted the course of a girl's life. How do we do this? How do we transform something? By making bold choices, even when they're not the easy ones. When we exercise free choice, we have these muscles within us that get strengthened. And we all have this ability to change our behavior and consequently our lives. And that strength comes from our soul, our neshama. That gift that we spoke about, that is created in the image of God, means you have within you the strength, the capability to make that choice and make the tough choice, that choice point where everything thereafter will flow far more naturally and easier. Growing up, I had the privilege of being in the presence of many, many great people, devout, God-fearing Jews who had this very profound impression upon me. And yet I will tell you that no less impressive than those heroes are another group of heroes, namely the people that I have met on my shlichus while serving as an emissary of the Rebbe in a place called Agoura Hills, California. Individuals, families, like many of you in this room right now, who grew up perhaps with very little, if any, Jewish knowledge or tradition. But then someone inspired them, or they walked into a Chabad center, or they took a class, and their interest piqued. And they were open to learning, open to growing, and slowly but surely, not overnight, but step by step, one mitzvah at a time, they changed their lives. Whether it was coming to shul, or keeping kosher, or keeping Shabbat, or putting on tefillin, whatever the mitzvah may be, those gradual changes, they found this new sense of connection to friends, to community, to themselves, and to God. Have they found an easier way of life? I don't know. What I can say is that they've certainly found a richer life, a deeper life, a more meaningful life, a more fulfilling way of life. They have discovered for themselves that which we say every day when we lift the Torah, we say, the ways of Torah are sweet and pleasant. The more we study it, the more we observe its mitzvos, we feel the changes in our lives. They've discovered for themselves that the Torah is not confining, but is in fact the ultimate freedom. They've discovered how liberating it feels to make positive changes in one's life. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks once said, to be a Jew is to be creative. And our greatest creation is ourself. Think about this. Throughout the Torah, especially the book of Genesis, book of Exodus, we're introduced to characters, we're introduced to individuals. And the more we get to know these individuals, the more we realize their characteristic is talking to us. There's something about them that we relate to. Think about it. Abraham grew up in an idol-worshipping household and rejected that lifestyle. Abraham changed himself. Moses started out as a man who could barely speak. I'm not a man of words. I am a slow speech and tongue, he said. Yet by the end of the Torah, he's the most eloquent visionary of all prophets. Moses went through changes. We all need to reinvent ourselves. Whoever we are, however we're all programmed, we can channel it to do good, to be good, to feel good, and to have good. Act like the person you want to be, and you will become that person. I'd like to conclude with the following story. It was told by Rabbi Yechiel Spiro. Although the suffering of Greek Jewry during World War II may not have been as well known as Jews from other European countries, the Jews of Greece actually endured a greater percentage of loss than almost any other country. Nearly 85% of the Jews of Salonika were killed, most of them in Auschwitz. There were the few, the 15% that survived and rebuilt their lives anew. Among them was a young man named Ovadia Baruch. Ovadia Baruch, after having a number branded on his arm, felt his life seeping out of him all alone. No family, no friends. He walked around the camp like a zombie. But then to his great fortune, he was given the job of doling out soup to his fellow inmates. He lucked out. Not only did he have now access to the kitchen, but he also had the ability to help others with a spoonful of extra soup. In the meantime, in the same camp, but on the other side of the camp, was a young woman by the name of Eliza Tsourfati, also from Greece. She, however, was not given any plum assignments. In fact, she was sent to the dreaded Block 10. Block 10 was where the cursed Nazis Yimach Shemam, they conducted their grotesque medical experiments on young women, robbing them of their ability to ever bear children. It was to that infirmary that Eliza was being led. And she had heard before what goes on in there. She was filled with trepidation and fear. As soon as she entered the clinic from hell, however, she looked up and she saw something that filled her with new levels of hate and disgust and anger, because she recognized the individual going in and out, performing those experimental procedures that day was none other than Dr. Jacob Samuels, a Jewish doctor. It was her turn. She looks at the doctor, and with every ounce of anger building up inside, she yells out, "How could you? I understand the animals, the Nazis, they're beasts. But you, you're a Jew. How can you participate in this? For what? To save your own hide? To get privileges? To get better rations of food? Shame on you." And a few moments later, it was over. The procedure that would prevent Eliza from ever having children. She was shattered. She could never have a family of her own. What is there to live for? A few days later, Eliza was walking past the back of the kitchen area when she hears someone screaming. He's screaming in Greek from behind the building, and she knows the language. Hearing the cries of her native tongue, she runs over and she sees an SS guard mercilessly beating on a young man because Avadya was caught giving some extra soup to a fellow Jew. And he's being beaten to death. And she starts yelling and screaming at the top of her lungs for this Nazi to stop. For some inexplicable reason, her cries to stop the savage in his tracks seemed to change his mind, and he went on his way, leaving Avadya on the ground. She begins to take care of his wounds. He thanks his savior profusely. Being a fellow landsman from Greece, they spoke for a few minutes in their native language. So overwhelmed was Avadya by the emotions of that moment of being saved by this woman who came from the same country that he came from, he blurts out to Eliza on the spot, "If we both survive, let's get married." Eliza couldn't help but burst out laughing, saying, "We don't know each other. We met about 60 seconds ago. And besides," she assured, "if you ever got to know me, you wouldn't want to marry me." And with that, they went their separate ways. Over the next 2 years, their paths didn't cross again. Even so, the story remained fresh in Avadya's mind. When the war was over and the camp was liberated, he began to search high and low for Eliza, for his girlfriend. Hitting many dead ends, but then after many months, he located her. And although they hadn't seen each other in over 2 years, Avadya did not forget her kindness. Moreover, removed from the horror of the camps, there was outer beauty there too that matched her inner beauty. And once again, in this spontaneous fashion, he asks her, "Let's restart our life together. Let's get married." Now the question was serious and it was real. And she had to reveal to him why she thought he wouldn't be interested. And she tells over what happened in Barrack 10 with Dr. Samuels. But Avadya wouldn't take no for an answer. He was intent on rebuilding his life with this woman, with Eliza. "And if we couldn't have a family of our own, let's have each other. Maybe we'll adopt, we'll find a way to rebuild our lives, but it has to be us together." And after much persuasion, Aliza agreed, and they got married. And sometime later, they were given an opportunity to go to the land of the dreams, and they grabbed it. And Ovadia and Aliza Baruch moves to Israel. A few months later, Aliza's not feeling well. She goes to see a doctor, and after examining her, he tells her the good news. You're expecting. You're pregnant. She thanks the doctor, but she says, Doctor, your test is false. It's not possible. And she tells him about Barak 10, what happened that day. And they do another test and another, and it confirms that she's pregnant. And she begins to do some research about any Jewish woman that went to Barak 10 under Dr. Samuels. And she finds that many of them have either had children or are pregnant with children. How could it be? They investigated further and they uncovered Dr. Samuel's secret. In truth, he had volunteered to perform those procedures. And yet, despite his orders under the threat of death, he knew how to make things appear as if he did what they wanted him to do. But he also knew how never to harm a single Jewish woman. Instead, he saved them. And he knew they hated him. And they called him every name they could. And they went on in their lives thinking he was the angel of death. When the Germans discovered his charade, they made him suffer. They tortured him before they executed him. 6 months later, Aliza and Avadia Baruch were holding their beautiful newborn baby at his breast. They named him Yaakov, after the tzaddik, the righteous martyr, Dr. Jacob Samuels of saintly memory. When faced with the most critical and consequential choice point in his life, Dr. Samuels did not choose the easy way. Though he well knew the price he'd have to pay, he chose to rise above the animal and become the angel. The angel that will allow Jewish children to be born for generations and generations and generations. My friends, as human beings, we have the power of free will. We're able to make choices that can better our lives and the lives of others. We can make the world a better and brighter place. When we're presented with those choice opportunities, let us seize them and forge this new way forward in our lives. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.